Becca, I'm delighted to have you with us today. It's a real pleasure. It would be great if you wouldn't mind, as we're covering a wide variety of topics in this podcast, if you could just give an introduction on who you are and what you do at Global Council.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me. So I lead the financial services practice at Global Council. Global Council is a, for want of a better explanation, a political and regulatory risk consultancy. We work with businesses to help them, and which has been an interesting challenge over the last 12 months, to help them understand politics, what's going on, how it might impact their business, and crucially, what they could do to try and have a better conversation with policymakers, both from a government perspective, but crucially from a business perspective. So how do you better engage between the two sides of the conversation, really? The reason I got into this and my background, I spent the best part of the last decade working in, I suppose, what we're going to call today traditional finance, with banks, payments, fintech, for the trade body UK Finance, advising them on media, communications, and public policy.
Wonderful. I think we'll go straight into it. There's a huge amount happening in the regulatory and policy agenda for crypto and digital assets. I'm going to ask you the big overview question. Can you describe some themes from your perspective that we're facing, particularly in the UK, in this industry right now?
Absolutely. I'm going to start with one giant overarching theme, which I think everything else sits underneath, which is this idea that policymakers do not wake up every morning thinking about crypto, digital assets, NFTs, or any other element of this universe. Nor do they wake up every morning thinking, how are they going to regulate it or legislate for it?
There's a huge amount happening in the regulatory and policy agenda for crypto and digital assets. Can you give us an outline of what is happening for the broad sector on a big theme? I know this is a big question.
Absolutely. I think there's one part that sort of shapes everything that's happening in the policy and regulatory space. And that might sound overly simplistic, but ultimately, the challenge we have right now is policymakers, particularly elected officials, don't wake up thinking about crypto. And when I say crypto, I suppose for purposes, I'm using it in its broadest sense right now. So that is all forms of decentralized finance, whether it is crypto assets, stablecoin, should we ever get them, central bank digital currency. And crucially, they don't wake up thinking about it. And the reason they don't wake up thinking about it is, by and large, they don't really understand what it is. They don't really see it as economically important yet. And what they do know is probably what they've read in the media. And so comes from an angle of, they've read about the crypto winter, they've read about declining values, they've seen what happened with FTX or Tether, or they've read something about money laundering, economic crime, illicit finance, or they've received a letter from one of their constituents about an investment scam they've been a victim of, where ultimately the money was going to some kind of crypto asset. And if that's what's shaping the overarching policy environment, and the debate that we then have as a country or an EU level or a multilateral international level is shaped by those experiences. And so the policy and regulatory agenda has effectively come down to, one, what is it that we're talking about? Do we understand what this asset is? Is it even an asset? Does it actually have intrinsic economic value and purpose? And if it does, how are we going to treat it? And if it doesn't, why are we even talking about it or allowing it to exist? So the second part of the policy conversation stems off that, which is, right, we found something with economic value. For example, stable coin used for the purposes of payments, which even the biggest crypto skeptic can say, actually, there is a value in being able to send value cross-border with limited delays in processing time, payment flows, or fees. So maybe that has a role, like digital payments has a role. But now, that sounds an awful lot like a financial transaction or some kind of financial pre-existing financial product. So whether that's the debate in the US about what is a security and what is a commodity, if you're the CFTC, the answer is everything's a commodity, or the debate in the UK, which is, in UK terms, what is inside and outside the FCA's purview, or as they like to call it, their regulatory perimeter. And for me, that's what's shaping the conversation right now. Are you a useful value product? If you are a useful value product, where do you sit in what we already know about the world? Are you some kind of financial product? And if you're not some kind of financial product, do we treat you like the rest of tech? And I think that's what's going to shape the next 12 months.
And it's a big question to ask. We have obviously the backdrop of FTX, and this past year, quite a few firms that have been perhaps behaving a little bit less than one would expect in good governance. Why do you think now is such an important time to engage with policymakers?
Now is a really important time to engage policymakers because people are starting to use these products and it's starting to get cut through. So if no one was using any form of crypto, then frankly, no one would care because the social and economic harm was zero. But and there's a lot of data out there. If you look at the growing amount of information available about consumer usage, and let's be honest, it's consumer usage of these products that is shaping the mainstream policy and political debate. There's data out there, and our own research at GC, which we did with Samantha over the last 12 months, shows people, probably 30% up to 30%, 25% upwards of the population have used at some point one of these assets. Well, if I'm an MP, that's vaguely terrifying. Like, that's up there in the polling numbers I take notice of. But also, if my mailbag is starting to tell me about people using these assets or not understanding these assets or having a go with these assets, again, I start to worry. And we see a lot of that historically, not to equate the products. Emerging financial products in recent years that have garnered political interest are things like payday lending. When payday lending became mainstream and there were adverts on broadcast and mainstream adverts, and then hum of stories being told, whether it was through Martin Lewis, a money saving expert, and anyone in financial services should never underestimate the influence of Martin Lewis, or whether it's through mailbags or whether it's through scam stories on the Daily Mail, that starts to get cut through, that starts to get noticed. So the first reason as to why now is that was starting to bubble up and we were starting to get the regulator. So the Financial Conduct Authority was using its annual reports, where it has this annual perimeter report where it says, here are things we're noticing in the economy that are happening outside our regulatory perimeter. And we've got a few concerns. And we've started over the last few years to see that bubbling through during the pandemic into the regulatory perimeter. We also saw it with Buy Now, Pay Later. The second reason was, if you grab the major business headlines with a story that says value of these currencies is plummeting beyond levels seen in plummeting shares or broader FX challenges, that's going to make politicians notice. And then if you have the single biggest corporate collapse, which is likened to Enron, unsurprisingly, that is also going to get cut through and significant political notice. And so you combine the growing use case and the growing usage with those major kind of scandal moments, and politicians will pick up on that, but crucially, policymakers will pick up on that. And that then aligns with what we'd already seen, which was a regulatory community that was already on this issue. So at a prudential level, so this is looking at the potential risk to financial stability, the international multilateral bodies had already carved out significant amounts of their agenda, whether that was Basel and the FSB or IOSCO. They all had very developed programs looking at stablecoin, the prudential risks of crypto more broadly, lending to crypto firms, etc. And then you saw the domestic regulators coming up the other way from a conduct point of view. So that was already happening quietly. But one thing they couldn't get was enough political capital to get space in the broader mainstream debate. In the UK, we almost had this kind of moment where the two things met head on, which was a regulator that knew they wanted to do something in the FCA. And if you're so minded, and I don't recommend that anyone is, if you go and listen to former Treasury Select Committee evidence sessions over the last 2 years, you can see the FCA's Director of Enforcement talking in very passionate, very emotive terms about likening crypto to gambling. And you can hear successive FCA CEOs and interim CEOs talking about their distrust of the sector and the fact that they don't really want to give this the regulatory halo of putting it inside the perimeter because they're just not sure it's valuable. So you have this FCA is going, we know we have to regulate it, but we really don't want to regulate it. So we're going to wait until we're forced. At the same time as politicians suddenly went, we can want to be a crypto hub and a fintech hub because it's the next wave on the UK's fintech journey. And post-Brexit, we're looking for opportunities for competitiveness. And we think this is one of them. So kind of in it for what we can build. And we know that building regulation probably, paradoxically, encourages investment. But also, we're a little bit nervous about the harms that we've seen with Tether, with other players, with kind of major market crashes. So we ended up with a slightly strange moment in the autumn. And you know, most people will not have noticed this in UK politics because what happened in the autumn was we had Liz Truss and we didn't have Liz Truss and everything that came with that. But at the same time as that was happening in Parliament, the government very quietly tabled amendment to its own bill, its own financial service and markets bill, which has been developing for 4.5 years. It quietly put an amendment in saying, we're not just going to regulate stablecoin. We're also going to use this as a mechanism to regulate crypto assets and force the UK regulators to go, really, we're at that point already. We've got there a bit quicker than we were ready or we wanted to. Right, this is now happening. How are we going to get on board? So those sort of alliances of factors and developments last year mean this year in the UK, it's all about defining what happens in that piece of legislation. And the Financial Services and Markets Bill will become law by the end of Q1.
Which is going to be a big impact for all of us in the space. I think for the better, it seems that we've done a lot of work with this in the Gauge. As you mentioned in your introduction, there is an understanding of what crypto is, I think, in the industry. But if you look at it as a word and you unpack that, there's a wide variety of solutions. There's the speculative side of the trading, which is more the retail end. And then there's the infrastructure plays that I think are probably much more interesting for long-term UK PLC. What are the key drivers that you think are hitting the political agenda on these two areas? Where are politicians really interested?
Ultimately, politicians are interested in the retail use case and also the retail risk case. That is what is going to drive the political debate. But they've given us the parameters of that conversation right now from a political perspective, which they've said, look, we see that this is happening. We see that utilization is high enough that we can't ignore it. So we're actually going to bring it inside the regulated perimeter. And interestingly, it's going to be brought inside the regulated perimeter ahead of buy now, pay later, which I think we would all say is probably a much more mainstream product. And despite the fact we had an emergency reviews 2 years ago during the pandemic to bring that in, it's deeply complicated. Or so I'm told by government, it's deeply complicated and there's still more we need to do. But actually what we're going to get in the case of crypto is the overarching rules that say you can bring this inside the regulated perimeter, the piece of primary legislation that we require in the UK, will be in place by Q1. So that's, in many ways, I think a lot of politicians will say, our job has been done. We have said this must be regulated. We've made it so. We've passed the legislation. Over to you, Financial Conduct Authority, Payment Services Regulator, Prudential Regulatory Authority. Please go and make it so. And in the UK, post-Brexit, we've given huge amounts of rulemaking power to the authorities. So in many ways, I think most politicians will think job done and dusted. Now, that leaves a few outposts where we'll likely see a lot of focus this year. One is the Treasury Select Committee. This is the parliamentary committee that is permanently in place to scrutinise Treasury. But ever since the financial crisis, it's had a secondary role, which it quite likes because it garners a lot of media interest, which is to scrutinise financial services, the regulation of financial services. So hauling the CEOs, the regulators in front of it. And I say hauling quite deliberately. Anyone that watched Andrew Bailey recorded just yesterday, we'll see that it wasn't an easy ride for him as he gave evidence to the committee on the decision of the Bank of England. But also they get to bring forward senior industry executives. So just before Christmas, we saw them interviewing a number of players in this market, be they crypto exchanges or issuers, to understand what they think the potential harm and opportunity might be. So I think we're going to see a lot of political focus right there. But as in all things financial services, that political focus will purely be on the retail side. And it's not unique to crypto. It's not even unique to fintech. If you talk to an international wholesale bank like Goldman Sachs or Citi, they will tell you the policy and political conversation in the UK, with the exception of Brexit, is always about the retail banking side. That's probably not a bad thing, because if they're focusing on the retail, it actually gives you time as an industry to have a much more intelligent conversation with the regulators about what do we actually need to do to get here. And to your question, that's probably focus on the infrastructure use cases and really make sure the UK doesn't inadvertently prevent progress in that space by over-regulating for other parts of the sector that they're concerned about. And I think we've got some pretty major interventions coming down the pipeline in the UK. So we are due a consultation on stablecoin, a consultation on crypto assets, a further consultation on systemic stablecoin, which could be aligned with the other consultation, and a consultation on the UK's approach to central bank digital currency. And we're told by the city minister, those are due within weeks. We're currently in the middle of January, so I fully expect we could see them by the end of this month or early February. That is going to dictate what we all spend the next 12 months thinking about for those of us that are minded to worry and invest time in thinking about the policy and regulatory landscape for crypto. And it's largely going to be about defining how we actually bring those rules into law. And there aren't that many examples out there for us to follow internationally. Traditionally, at this point in the policymaking cycle, you might say, oh, look at what they've done in the US or look at what they've done here. And I think there'll be a lot of nervousness in the sector if we were to say, look at what they've done in the EU, because MiCA has many qualities, but the market and crypto assets regulations brought forward by the EU also have many flaws. And there's an opportunity for the UK to build a safe, resilient regime, but do it differently. And I would say, look to the US, but they're behind where we are now. Their political debate's been even more difficult than ours, so they're not yet making progress. So there is a chance for the UK to do something really exciting here and hopefully set a stall out for what others could follow.
We can but hope. Currently, I think we have four different definitions in law of what crypto assets are. Do you think that's accidental or deliberate?
I think it's entirely accidental. During the passage of the Financial Services and Markets Bill, we got that definition of digital assets at the start. And I was looking at it, I was like, I'm amazed there hasn't been more industry conversation about this. Like, this is our moment to define digital assets. If I think about the amount of time that was debated over the years defining fraud or other key terms within financial services. This is going to set its store out quite firmly. But then all of a sudden, we got a definition of crypto assets. As you say, we've seen other definitions come forward in sort of time. And I think actually that we haven't devoted more time to this right now is potentially problematic. I think we're going to find ourselves reviewing it and amending it quite early on in the lifetime of this law in order to address this. And that's one of the challenges of regulating for innovative technologies, which is how do you keep pace and how do you actually make sure your definitions and your terms are suitable for the long term? And this is just one example of that challenge. The Law Commission, which is one of the most arcane elements of the UK policymaking process, has been tasked with looking at this ahead of the passage of the legislation. And you can see there's a genuine sort of lack of certainty and clarity around how they want to treat certain things, even to the point that it looks like NFTs were basically going to be defined as crypto assets in every form. I think there's a lot in the sports NFT community would say, well, wait a minute, there are a few key distinctions. So I do think that we have so many definitions is definitely problematic, but also whether we really thought long and hard about if they are sufficient or suitable.
I know that you're very interested in this industry, but you've seen a lot of different industries in your time in financial services. How important is terminology in setting the stage so that we can all agree on common terms?
I think terminology, when you talk to regulators and to the technical policymakers, is really important. I actually think the more important piece of terminology within the industry right now is how the sector talks about itself as a sector. And that's everything from, do we define it as crypto, or do we accept that crypto may already be a term too tainted to resurrect and recover? And should we be focusing more around digital assets? And if we're talking about digital assets, how do we actually explain to policymakers what this industry is? But crucially, how do we explain the use cases and the genuine value it can bring? I've seen too many attempts within the industry to explain this as if they were talking to another participant in the industry. And actually, very rarely does someone step back and say, well, at the end of the day, it means you can pay someone cross-border without relying on the existing infrastructure. Or here's a very live project we're running in Ukraine about facilitating and unlocking access to aid. And actually, I think we spend a lot of time trying to define to ourselves what the industry is, but also what the industry isn't. And I find it fascinating that we've now got this demarcation in financial services. You've got TradFi, you've got FinTech, and then you've got digital assets. It's like, never the twain should the three meet. And I just wonder why we spent so long worrying about differentiation than actually saying, there might be advantages sometimes at being considered a financial services firm rather than a tech firm. Because at the end of the day, we're going to be regulated for like financial services firms. So maybe if they think about it as a bit more in that light, that might be helpful to breaking down some of the barriers.
Well, with the Web3 vision, I mean, some of these things won't even be transparent to consumers to the extent they can, yes, but often people just want funding or solutions.
Absolutely. And I think that's critical. We did a big piece of research last year on Web3. And the first thing we learned was we couldn't call it Web3. We ended up going out and talking to consumers about the metaverse, which, you know, was not ideal and not the phrase we were looking to use. But crucially, the metaverse was the only terminology there that had any form of resonance and understanding. And we didn't just talk to consumers, we also talked to regulators and policymakers and experts in broader related industries. And again, we ended up coming back to that metaverse terminology. But we also started testing awareness and understanding of the metaverse, Web3, crypto, NFT, DeFi. And one thing was really stark in all the research. Consumer understanding was incredibly low. Consumer understanding was incredibly skeptical. And something that was unique to the UK compared to France and compared to the US was, normally in these surveys, when you talk to someone and say, do you want this term? And then you do a focus group and you use the focus group to do some education work and explain more about the terms, confidence and trust grows. In the UK, confidence and trust declined in all of the terminologies. And it's something we've seen in our research in the metaverse, but in broader business research more generally, there was a very low level of trust in tech in its broadest forms in the UK. And that bleeds through into crypto and digital assets. And actually, if you start to think about why, and we're coming up with ideas as to why now, I've been trying to unpick this, there's no real advocate for this industry in the UK. Who is banging the drum in a public debate for the sector? It might once have been Matt Hancock from a parliamentary and political perspective, but actually who is genuinely out there in the media fighting for the value of this industry? Even if you look at France, you've got strong backing from the French government for encouraging investment in tech and encouraging investment in crypto and digital assets. We had a big set speech last year from Rishi Sunak, although he couldn't give it. So it was given by the then City Minister, John Glenn, about making the UK the leading crypto hub. was it that big? Was it that exciting? Or was it the absolute bare minimum the UK needed to say to remain credible on the financial stage? And I do worry that we've taken for granted that lack of leading voice and that lack of leading defence. And it's not like either part of the brand for the industry is strong. Financial services post 2008 carries heavy scepticism, and tech following the tech lash carries heavy scepticism in the UK. So as straddling stools goes, it's a pretty difficult debate reputationally for the industry. And I do worry we haven't spent enough time thinking about how we actually get over those bumps.
The million-pound question then is, what could we do better as an industry? We have trade groups, we've got all-party parliamentary groups. What could we achieve?
I think a lot of time is often spent extolling the virtue of individual brands, which makes complete sense. In a kind of nascent early stage industry, there's obviously a critical role commercially and financially and for encouraging investment in ensuring your senior leadership, your brand, your product offering is understood. But actually, I think if we learn anything in 2008 within the banking sector about how reputation works for these sectors, a single bad actor damages the whole industry. No one thinks, oh, that banking scandal was just insert name of bank. They think all banks, they're all the same, aren't they? And I think the same carries over into crypto and digital assets. You have very limited understanding, so it all gets lumped together. It's all the same thing. It's all one type of activity. So actually, there is strength in shared initiative. There is strength in shared education and shared collaboration to drive forward trust and responsibility. But also, there is value in working with the grain of the public sector debate and actually working in partnership with the public sector. The Edible and Trust Barometer obviously comes out, I think it's due to come out imminently in January every year. But there's some really interesting research that came out in a recent edition looking at the importance of public-private partnership, not just in what public-private partnership can achieve, for example, working in partnership to address economic crime and illicit finance concerns, but actually the reputational benefit of being able to say as an industry, we worked with the government, we worked with the public sector to solve this social harm. Normally, industries don't have to worry about that kind of work until they're fully established, existing over the long term. Given the challenging reputational debate for this industry, I do wonder if there isn't more the sector can be doing to lean into those conversations early in order to manage and mitigate some of the risks, particularly as one of the things the sector is rightly or wrongly perceived to be doing is bringing risk into the financial system and risk into the regulatory system. So leaning into, well, this is actually how DLT technology can be utilized to address economic crime concerns or fraud concerns. This is how we can help with making part of the internet safe in the way that we can do verification. But working with the public sector in those initiatives, I think could go a long way to not just bolstering direct trust with public sector and policymakers to open up a dialogue that you can then broaden out into other areas, but to actually engender broader public trust in the sense of actually maybe these guys do want to do the right thing and they're not just in it for themselves or the quick funding that can be made by the industry. And I do think there is a moment and opportunity to try and build those relationships as individual firms, but also through the trade associations and through the industry groups that have been built to date and that could be evolved and taken further.
I was speaking with another founder recently who isn't it like Greengage is for the long game. We're looking at broader topics, engagement. We also want a level playing field. I think one of the things that regulation excites me about, I don't often get excited about regulation, is getting the good actors into a room together and hopefully allowing us to have an environment where people can have trust. Do you think that's something that we'll see in short order?
I think for the actors that care and the actors that, as you say, are in this for the long term, it is something we can see. It takes a long time to build trust within industries to actually enable those conversations to happen. And there are lessons that can be learned from sectors that do it well and sectors that are comfortable in that space to enable a better conversation. And I think one of the first things where I've seen it work well and where I've seen it work effectively is getting to that point where firms realize this conversation isn't about speaking my business's book. I think that's particularly hard for early stage growth companies because you're so committed to, as founders, to finding that investment and to driving forward change. But it's getting to that point where you say, actually, this is about parking my pure commercial advantage at the door and having a conversation about what's right for the sector and what's right for the industry as a whole. And where I've often seen it work effectively is when an industry is faced with genuine crisis. So if I think to the start of the pandemic and to draw an analogy from banking and financial services, we had a senior leadership at the top of retail banking, which were a rare thing. They remembered the last major crisis. Normally in corporates, there's enough time has passed that the senior leadership has changed, but they were in senior roles in the banking sector at the time of 2008. Not the C-suite, we've seen that change, but senior roles. So they remembered it and they remembered what the industry got right and also crucially what the industry got wrong. And I think there was a real sense that there were two risks. One, we needed to act quickly to do what was right for our customers, be they businesses or consumers. But also two, the public wasn't going to forgive us as an industry if we got this wrong. Others, sectors, retail, other parts of the economy, probably get a bit of a kind of run-in to figure out how to deal with a global pandemic and get this right. Banking doesn't, because we had our crisis and we need to have learned from it and we need to act quickly. And I think that really focused mine. So the conversations that happened in the room weren't how could I, individual firm, use this to grow my back book or make progress. It was how do we get money to vulnerable customers who are isolating at home in a way that we've never had to before? How can we help the business design a lending program that's genuinely going to help SMEs at pace? And the first design didn't work, but we got there eventually with Balfour Loans. It wasn't perfect, but there was also an acceptance, probably not going to be perfect, but it needs to be quick and it needs to be substantive. And I think those crisis moments often trigger the right kind of behaviors for an industry to start having those conversations that are much more pragmatic and saying, well, actually, what do we need as an industry? It might not be 100% of everything I want, but it's probably better to all lean in and move forward than to keep driving our own agenda. I would say for the crypto sector right now, we're at some pretty critical moments that mean having that mindset is going to be key to navigate in the next 12 to 18 months effectively. And maybe FTX isn't significant enough on its own, but if we see another major collapse or another major scandal coming over in the short to medium term, and I don't think any of us have ruled out that we won't see that, then the political appetite to hear anything this industry has to say is going to be very low. Unless the industry's done some hard work to say, actually, we get that this needs to be done differently. We're leaning into regulation, and we're not just leaning into regulation because we have to, because that narrative is already being written. That, of course, you're saying that now, you have to, you sort of missed the boat, but actually showing that behavior's changed and showing that there's more you proactively want to do. It's not going to be an easy conversation to start. Those rooms are never easy to build. But if there was ever something to trigger that kind of behavior, I think we've hit that moment.
That is a great call to arms. Thank you so much, Becca. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for everything you're doing for the industry.
Not at all. Thank you very much.